This is a YUN interview with Alejandro Bandana, the former spokesman of the Sandinista Party. The interview is in Managua, Nicaragua. The interviewer is Sutherland. The date was July the 29th, 1997.
Technically speaking, the elections were constitutionally described. There was elections held in 1984, so these were not the first elections under the Sandinista government. And under the terms of the Constitution, elections were to take place in 1990, in November of 1990. What made the election extraordinary were two factors. The first one was that they were brought forward from November to February. And secondly, that there were very important modifications of the electoral law, including the whole regime of political liberty. This, in essence, was part of a package of concessions, you might say, that took place within the framework of the Esquipulas peace process. Now, there's two stages to the peace process. One is the one that's known as Contralora, which begins January 83, and did an extraordinary amount of work, if you're familiar with the members of the Contralora, in trying to avert the regionalization of the war. Everything has to do with the war. The war, which, as Contralora viewed it, and as most of the Latin American community viewed it, with the exception of the Salvadorians, Hondurans, and Guatemalans, was that on account of the Nicaraguan Revolution and on account of the Reagan administration's first day decision to counterpose it and to show his macho anti-Soviet credentials at our expense, as the record now shows, the CIA was unleashed, and what would have been an ordinary, normal internal opposition to a revolution, which was inevitable, turned into an effort aided, abetted, assisted, organized, financed, and directed by a central intelligence agency to simply be rid of the Nicaraguan Revolution and overthrow the Nicaraguan government, either in violation of international law and in violation of what were the Boland Amendments, etc. What this meant was that the Nicaraguan War was never quite a civil war, nor was it a full-fledged international war. The Contra camps were in Honduras under Honduran protection, under Honduran army sustenance with the pipelines going into them. The Contras could penetrate, could come in, they weren't ever allowed to take a major city or a major town, but this continued to rise. The danger was, and this is where Contadora comes into being, was that for the Nicaraguan to defend itself and the army, the temptation was to go over the border. And if you went over the border, that would have meant a regional conflagration. In fact, the border was crossed a number of times. And at a certain point, the 82nd Airborne was called out when the Honduran president was told by the American ambassador to request assistance because his country was being invaded and the Hondurans really didn't know about it. Contadora suffers from one central contradiction, that there's three dimensions to the problem. One is the internal Nicaraguan dimension, the Sandinista government and its armed opposition. The second one is the Honduran Nicaraguan, and to a lesser extent, Nicaraguan El Salvadorian dispute on account of Salvadorian and Honduran territory being used as a base of aggression against Nicaragua. And could have a third one, which was a Nicaraguan support for the rebels in El Salvador. And then there was, fourth was direct United States and Cuban involvement in the conflict. So you broke it down into four aspects. But the Contadora process had difficulties juggling all four, because the tendency of the right and of the United States was to say, this is simply a Nicaraguan problem. If the Nicaraguans just speak to their opposition, everything will be fine. And the thing is that before 1986, and this explains the failure of the Contadora process, the United States simply refused to countenance an internal political settlement in Nicaragua. It still was able to believe that it could break the Sandinista regime. Hence, when you had the elections of 1984, American policy was that there should be no active opposition, something that was to vary dramatically from 1990. That is to say, the principal candidates were dissuaded from participating, and all this is documented, so as to not to be in detriment of the armed contra opposition. In fact, the main political leaders like Calero, Cesar, and others were to become members of the leadership of the Nicaraguan resistance. So it was sort of an inconvenience to the United States to have a civic opposition which would have given Nicaraguan the semblance of being a democracy, because in Oliver North's terms, we were simply a Soviet satellite, but a Soviet satellite that had newspapers, that had 18 different parties, that had a whole series of things that simply don't fit in, and especially a constitution which looked more like the constitution of Costa Rica than it did that of Cuba. And by this time, the Reagan administration is emotionally, morally, fully committed to its freedom fighters. So Contadora ran up against this. The Nicaraguan government's position was, yes, we can talk to our neighbors. No, we won't talk to the Contras. We want to talk to the people who are directing the Contras, and those are the people in Washington. So for a time, right before 1984, there was a previous lapse in the U.S.-Nicaraguan high-level dialogue, known as the Manzanillo talks. But as it's shown in books that were written about it, this was more sort of it took place not with regard to finding a settlement, but rather with trying to to appease what was a very strong congressional opposition. So there's three sides in this triangle. It's not only Nicaragua and the Central Americans, but the whole congressional and public opinion dimension weighed very, very heavily. And to the point, as you know, of leading the Reagan administration to countenance outright illegality, Iran-Contra, etc., in defiance of what was a public will and a public law. So the 1984 elections do take place, but they are weakened because the principal opposition candidate has been heavily pressured, this was Arturo Cruz, to withdraw, not to participate. And so they were called Soviet sham elections, even though by historical standards or Central American standards, they weren't that bad. What happened, therefore, was that the 1984 elections, although they were won internally, they were lost externally. That is to say, the United States campaign and charges of reckless accusations of campaign harassment said, well, this was not a free election. And so the very legitimacy that Nicaragua needed, that battle in public opinion, which was absolutely crucial to any small nation that's trying to defend its sovereignty, because obviously we weren't going to win a major conflict with the United States and wanted to avert. The real battle was in public opinion and in Congress. Well, this, and with the Europeans, the elections did not achieve that external legitimacy that we would have wanted. The economic situation continues to deteriorate very, very bad. The military situation was more or less in hand, but the economic situation was running out of control. The embargo was in place. There were sabotages. The perestroika, the oil flow problem begins to get more serious. And this begins to open up a new space for a new possibility. Whereas Contralora had been there sort of a guarantor so that the five Central American nations could talk among each other, because there were also bases in Costa Rica. And within the Central American context, we had a 4-against-1 situation. A Contralora sort of served as a counterweight, and especially as a counterweight toward the United States. And one time that the Contralora countries did try to involve the United States and get it off the back to allow the peace process to work, that is to say by ending support or suspending support for the Contralora, well, Schultz practically told them to mind their own business, and this was his backyard. So that by 86, 87, conditions are beginning to change. There's the change in administration in Washington in 86. The Nicaraguan economy is screaming at that point. And so that new conditions, new opportunities begin to open up. There's the initiation of a new dialogue with Gorbachev, and then there's this illusion that all regional conflicts could be solved. Bush has a rather different outlook, and Baker, as you know, made it a first priority to get the Central American issue off its back, because it hampered a whole series of initiatives that he wanted to do that. So so they begin to push forward. And this is the opportunity that someone like Oscar Arias is able to see. You see, now Arias is not the genius he's made out to be, but he simply picks up where Pontarola has left off, and he picks up also on something that Vinicio Cerezo, the president of Guatemala, had begun in an Esquipulas One conference, which was in, I think, which was in 86, and in which for the first time, for some quirky reason, the five Central American presidents had actually met, and on their own, although it was for some sort of ceremonial or the Central American Parliament or something started of that nature. But Cerezo, Emilio says, wants to begin, let's get a symmetry going. Pontarola says, this is fine, this is what we've been working with so that the Central Americans will talk among themselves. Arias begins to put forth a plan, and I think his principal claim to fame is the fact that when the United States got wind of the plan, and the plan calls, among other things, for the disarmament and demobilization of armed contingents, along with amnesty. Elliot Abrams hit the ceiling and tried to get a change, and much to Arias's benefit, and much to the intelligence of the Nobel Prize Committee, they acted with it and giving him support, giving him the prize, so as to allow him the possibility of pushing forth a plan which might be acceptable to the Nicaraguans. It might be acceptable to the Honduras, because they weren't happy about it either. So there's a whole series of stories about how, during the negotiations, the U.S. ambassador and the others, when they were Reagan on the line trying to get the entire thing sabotaged, and at a certain point, the five Central American presidents just had to shut themselves up in a room with no advisors there, nobody taking phone calls until they hammer out a document called the Esquipulas II or the Arias plan. The essence of the Arias plan was, first of all, was that it was a plan for everybody. This was for all the five nations, and even though the Costa Ricans didn't have much of a problem, or the Honduras didn't, but it was valid for Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And you can pin the initiation of the internal dialogues to this effort, even though each one went in their own dynamic, culminating at different points. But what most people had in mind at that time, that even if it was a package settlement, therefore agreements for all of each of the nations to take, it was really addressed at Nicaragua and a sort of a face-saving thing, whether it was going to be addressed, it was going to be initiated by all. It wasn't a peace plan for Nicaragua, it was a peace plan for the region. In a nutshell, what the Arias peace plan calls is for countries to broaden political liberties, offer amnesty, offer guarantees, reform legislation, freedom of the press on the one hand, and on the other hand, an ending of support for external insurgencies, which was sort of aimed at Cuba, but more than Cuba than at the United States, so that the insurgencies would, in the light of the new political space, not really have a room for fighting, and then therefore there could be a reconciliation processes in each country, national reconciliation processes in commissions to be set up in the different countries, and the beginnings of an initial dialogue. Well, all this was difficult because it was a stumbling block, not only for Nicaragua, but for El Salvador to make the recognition of belligerency of the Contras as such, whereas before we had been saying, we don't talk to the monkeys but to the zookeepers, now we were going to have to talk to the monkeys. And And in that sense, they have a question. Well, you ask for amnesty first, and then we talk, and then we'll talk a ceasefire. No, the ceasefire first, political guarantees later. And that went back and forth. But the peace, but the subsequent summits, two things were linked in, and this time more directly and more specifically in terms of Nicaragua. One was to bring forth the electoral timetable and to link this with the demobilization and disarmament of the colonists. Supposedly these were going to be parallel tracks, so that elections could be held with the country at peace, with the Contra demobilized, and an election would be their guarantee that whatever they had been fighting for, the civil liberties, this and the other, would have materialized, and the new terms of the electoral conditions were one that was to be agreed with a whole series of the internal parties, and that was took place in August of, I think this was about August of 89 at the pre-Tela summit, in which, and then after a three-night session in Managua, with all the parties, a new electoral framework is devised, which is extraordinarily unprecedented by most standards, even more liberal than that of the United States, and which was in which helped explain why the elections were lost, because in terms of it allowing foreign financing for the parties, allowing giving a series of facilities and just opening the door wide open for external support, but instead of it may have tilted the field not only against the Sandinistas, but we wouldn't know. But in any case, it was extraordinarily open. There was a consensus on that, and the hope was that a consensus reached between the Sandinista government and a whole series and the entire spectrum of internal legal political parties would then go to Tela, because along with that sign, we agree at this, and we also call on the Contra to demobilize. And boom, that was taken to Tela. And Tela, Honduras, the president signed on to that and said, yes, there must be a plan to demobilize the Contras, to disarm the Contras, give them the guarantees. That's where we begin to think of where the United Nations involvement could take place, what form it could take.
Just one minute. There's one point that mm-hmm. you're getting very close to. Mm-hmm. The advantage for the Sandinista government, as they saw it at this point, at Tela, was that this offered the possibility of getting rid of the Contras. So would you put it that way?
Incorporating the Contras as a political force.
Yes.
For them to become a political movement, for them to cease to be an armed force.
And to bring about an end to the U.S. support of the Contras.
Right. One was linked to the other. Because this was driven. When you call for the Contra disarmament, what shocked the administration was that they should end it. By this time, there was a greater openness, because this is also directed at the U.S. Congress. Remember that Jim Wright is very much involved in all of this, and he knows what's going on step by step. So it was sort of a triangular diplomacy going on there, so that the moment that these things are announced, the community to Congress and the administration is left, well, look, everything we've been asking for, they're giving. Now, so what excuse can there be for continuing to provide humanitarian aid or whatever they want to call it to the Contras? And at a certain point, I think the aid was suspended, and this would have been a further inducement for the Contras to be able to return and under a United Nations plan. This is where the first thought comes up of the CIAL. They would be the ones to collect arms, to offer guarantees along with UNHCR, support, security guarantees, etc., 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 everything that that they needed to rehabilitate themselves, including facilities to form a political party and participate in the elections, so that in the end, what happened was that the elections were held and the Contras never been mobilized. And one of the most difficult decisions that had to be made in those months by the Sandinista government was to whether to go ahead with the elections in the light of a renewal of what had been a commitment to demobilize. That is to say, the demobilization did not precede elections. In fact, it sort of obeyed. We don't know how honest the United States might have been in that, because if the Sandinistas would have, the question was, had the Sandinistas won, would the Contras have been demobilized? We'll never know the answer to that. But there were a lot of people betting that if the Sandinistas won, and we know of plans that were there, ready, in the State Department, to begin to repeat the 1984 episode and begin to denounce the whole February 25 election as a fraud, because a lot of people expected the Sandinistas to win. The big shock was that they lost.
Let me ask you, in this connection, did the incorporation of the United Nations in the plan, both in the form of UNAM and CIAB and particularly UNCA, have an importance for you from this point of view? Because, in effect, the United States had agreed to these, including UNCA, which meant, in principle, that the resistance couldn't come across the border anymore. So my question is, did the United Nations seem to you to be some kind of a guarantee that in the end the conditions that are set forth in Tel Aviv would be fine?
Yes, but let's go a step or two backward. I think the crucial battle was a crucial battle held, I'm not certain anymore about the date, in which, in this confrontation with the United States, Nicaragua did not feel it could go to the OAS. We had to make a legal diplomatic battle to take the matter to the Security Council. And you're aware that there's a discrepancy in the charter for the regional disputes or annual by the way versus Article 33 or whatever it is that says that any security situation. The United States did its utmost to say, as it had historically with regard to its interventions in Latin America, to say, no, sorry boys, this is off to the OAS, the Security Council has nothing to do with that. One of the breakthroughs was that we were able to put this dispute, a bilateral dispute after a series of the bombing of, I don't remember if it was the mining of the ports or the overflights. Some of these drastic violations or the big revelations came out on the front page of Newsweek, how the U.S. was just preparing troops, for God's sake, in Miami to attack Nicaragua. And this was all over the papers. And the decision was that we couldn't go to the OAS. The OAS was particularly dominated, but historically dominated, weren't going to get very far, whereas in the Security Council we might get a hearing. And with the Soviet presence there, there might be an equitable chance of getting there. So then the UN is seen as the instance that we want to begin to get involved in Central America. That's the first point. The second point was to do something that had been absolutely unprecedented, which again had Pérez de Cuellar pulling his hair out, and that was to get the UN to observe an election for the first time in an independent country.
That's right.
Because Namibia before, but that was that. And this gave all the jurists a huge headache. You know, this is a provision. This to do now. Now they're looking for more elections to do. But Nicaragua was the first And this has to do with the earlier consideration I made. In the 84 election, we had lost externally, but won internally. The crucial thing about the 1990 election was that we had to win internally and externally. There could be not a shadow of a doubt that this was a clean election. The only way to do that was to have a massive, unprecedented international observation with some of the highest people. So we got all the Carters involved and these involved and the international socialists, but above all, and we asked the Secretary General to send, to set up a mission, which was almost then headed by Lisa. And you know, after a long debate, they accepted it. The United States went along with it, I think somewhat hesitantly.